From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Having failed to repeal, President Trump is taking steps on Obamacare that Democrats call sabotage. What's he up to? And why is he having Twitter fights with Republican Senator Bob Corker? Reporter Robert Costa from The Washington Post will tell us if this week was more chaotic than normal at the White House. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. In other Trump news, he's decertifying the Iran deal, but not actually pulling out of it. He's also telling Puerto Rico they'll have to fix their own problems eventually. We'll discuss what he's on about. Later in the show, Brad Plumer of the New York Times Climate Desk will join us to discuss the Trump administration's pro-coal policies. And screenwriter Kelly Goff will join us to discuss Hollywood post-Weinstein. All that, plus Trump's tax cut for America's richest truckers, is up ahead. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Robert Costa. He's a national political reporter at The Washington Post and host of PBS's Washington Week, which airs on Friday evenings. The Trump White House made two key announcements about the Affordable Care Act this week. The president directed agencies to make rules allowing the more flexible sale of cheap health plans that don't have to cover key essential benefits and can sometimes even refuse to cover pre-existing conditions. The White House says this will give people options more tailored to their needs, while defenders of Obamacare say the order may destabilize health insurance markets. All that said, it's unclear how much the order will matter either way, since a lot of it's on pretty shaky legal ground. Speaking of legal restrictions, the Trump administration also announced it will stop paying subsidies that go to insurers who cover low-income Obamacare participants. These are the so-called CSR payments that Trump has been threatening to cut off all year and cause problems in insurance markets. The president now says the payments he's made for the last 9 months are actually illegal because Congress never appropriated funds for them. And a federal court actually agrees with him on that. Robert, Democrats are describing these moves as a strategy to sabotage the Affordable Care Act, that Republicans couldn't repeal the law, so now they're trying their best to make it fail. Is that how people in the White House see what they're up to? What does the president think he's doing?
They do want to break apart the Affordable Care Act. And what we're seeing from the president is in part a reaction to the GOP-controlled Congress being unable to legislate reforms to the nation's health care law. At the same time, you really see this White House walking away from any kind of bipartisan fix to the Affordable Care Act. Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, said in an interview today that the plan being floated on Capitol Hill by Senator Murray of Washington, a Democrat, Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, a Republican, that would shore up the markets, the White House wasn't supportive of that, and that they would rather just go after the subsidies and try to gut the law with executive authority.
So, Katrina, this then does sound like sabotage.
Oh, I think it's sabotage. It's throwing a bomb into the broken healthcare. It's throwing a bomb into the insurance markets. Trump now owns a broken healthcare system, and I think Republicans are going to. I think Democrats run on this. Trump now owns the Republicans now own this system. This isn't just letting Obamacare fail. I mean, these are active measures designed and likely to undermine the pillars of the 2010 law, and you know. As someone wrote the other day, the Pottery Barn rule comes to mind. You break it, you own it. And as Barack Obama learned after the Great Recession, heavy Democratic losses in the 2010 midterms, it's hard to blame your predecessor for a problem 2 years after you take office. But one thing that's clear is that this president is about not simply dismantling the administrative state, but about rolling back everything Obama.
So if we think about the practical effects of what this will do, especially the thing where they stop paying these subsidies, it's uncertain because we don't know exactly what insurers will do. States will sue, insurers will sue, trying to force the federal government to make these payments. It could get tied up in the courts. But basically, if this works in the way the president seems to be intending to disrupt the markets, what could happen is that health insurers would pull out of markets in a substantial number of places, probably especially rural areas. It would become impossible for a lot of people to buy health insurance in the individual markets. So like, if the president is doing that, won't people notice, Rich, that's what the president is up to? It feels like it doesn't make sense politically to have a strategy that explicitly involves making people miserable.
Right. Yeah, I think the executive order on the associated health plans is something any Republican would have done. A Marco Rubio administration would have done the same thing. Creates more options. Yes, creating more options is bad for Obamacare, but I don't know why Republicans who believe people should have more options should let that stop them. This is something that we talked about at the possibility several weeks ago, and I thought he'd continue to be talked out of it. Tom Price was continually trying to talk him out of it because the politics are so bad. But these payments are illegal. I mean, this money needs to be appropriated by Congress, and it wasn't. And we're in a weird situation because Obama stretched the laws in so many ways to act unilaterally, where we now have a system of sort of discretionary legality. You can decide whether Trump can decide whether it suits him or not to decide things are so illegal he's going to roll them back or not, which is not the way the system's supposed to work. But the politics, yes, this means is another step towards Republicans owning a status quo that's even going to be worse than the prior Obamacare status quo. And I think the political effect is to cause more pain and pressure Republicans on the Hill more than Democrats and push them not, this isn't going to be the magic bean that gets them over the top on Graham Cassidy or anything else. It's more likely to push them into the arms of Patty Murray. And this is where the White House strategy is just incoherent, because you have Trump, floating on Twitter, I'm going to work with Chuck Schumer on this. At the same time, you have others in the White House saying, no, we don't want any bipartisan deals. We just want this system to unravel. And it's not a strategy, and it's not very sustainable.
So, Bob, you were saying that the president doesn't seem to want to sign something like that bipartisan compromise, but there's going to be coming up in December, they have to pass another funding bill to keep the government open. So it seems to me like it would be very likely that Democrats would demand to attach this to that, to fund these payments in order to stabilize the insurance markets. Is that expected to be the fight in December over a government shutdown?
Yeah, that brings up an intriguing point I've picked up in my reporting, which is, when I asked some people at the White House, what's this really all about, this sudden move on CSR payments and the subsidies? And they said, in a way, it's outlining the president's position, but it's a position in a negotiation. And ahead of the budget talks, they're still under pressure from the base to get something maybe on the wall, to do something a little more conservative on health care. And so in some ways, as much as this is a deliberate, as Katrina said, a sabotage of the current health care law, it is also part of a negotiation over the budget, in that they want to try to get something from the Democrats, because you do see the president talking behind the scenes to Minority Leader Schumer and other Democrats about some kind of broader deal on health care. But he's taken a hard line in October ahead of those further talks.
So is the idea then that the president would use this as a bargaining chip to get money for the wall? That's the thing that he would ask for in that December deal?
I think the wall always remains one of the biggest targets for this White House, but they know that the wall probably won't happen, so maybe it's some kind of border security. But they believe, rightly or wrongly, I'm not here to say, but they do believe that they have to negotiate with a hard line to get anything out of the Democrats and to have any kind of legislative success.
I think Democrats right now believe they're the ones with leverage. I mean, they've called it sabotage, and the politics, I think, as Rich suggested, I mean, play in their favor on this. Trump will try to blame the Affordable Care Act on something, but it's going to fall on his back, and he'll pay the price for it. And if just stepping back, the contrast is so clear, the stark difference between the two parties on this. Republicans want to strip millions of health insurance, including seniors in the last days of life, disabled women with infants, and Democrats want everyone to have the right to affordable health care. There is a choice. Horse trading or not.
What I think this means is it makes even clearer that Obamacare will not be the endpoint of American health care.
That's right.
In the medium term. We're either going
backwards or forwards. Backwards or forwards.
I want to take a step back and talk more broadly about the week in this White House, because I feel like there's been a lot of writing and coverage this week suggesting that this week was some sort of breaking point. Senator Bob Corker said on Twitter that the White House has turned into an adult daycare. Gabriel Sherman had this piece for Vanity Fair describing associates of the president saying that he's venting, that he says that he hates everyone in the White House, that he has dark moods and he rambles. And I've been of two minds about this stuff, because there are some signs that this week is different. Tom Barrack, who's this real estate developer, who's a close associate of the president, made public comments about things that he's very concerned about what the president is doing. But on the other hand, it feels like we could have heard some of this stuff any week. People would have said the president has dark moods, the president is rambling. Bob, do you think this week is different, that there's been a real change at the White House?
It was notable that Chief of Staff General John Kelly came out to the lectern in the press room this week to try to say he's not being fired. And he did it with a bit of a wry smile that today he's not being fired, he's not going to resign. But there's this kind of chatter, as you report in this White House every day, about the tumult inside, about the president's mood swings, about his frustration with the stalled agenda, frustration with his own aides. And Tom Barrack, who is a confidant of the president, he I think is reflective of a lot of unease in the broader Trump orbit about where this is all going. But you do see in this White House also a real heavy hand from Kelly, from Secretary Mattis at the Defense Department, Henry McMaster, the general running the National Security Council, on things like the Iran deal, on handling the North Korea crisis. They're trying to be more of a steady presence, and that even as the president fumes about domestic issues in his own party on foreign policy, they're trying to keep his rhetoric in line as much as they can.
Well, there are a number of these things, though, that we actually literally have heard before. I mean, he's mused aloud about cracking down on the media before. I mean, that doesn't make it any better, but this is a trope of his, and he's insulted Republican senators before. So some of this might be a sign. Yes, all the criticism is getting to him. Maybe he in some sense, is deeply unhappy and unraveling. But a friend of his a couple of weeks ago told me something about him that was kind of eye-opening for me. And he just says, you have to understand about Donald Trump. This is true today. It's been true through most of his life. He wakes up every morning not wanting to be bored. So we might look at those tweets of Bob Corker and say, you know, the president's losing his mind. He just might be enjoying himself because it makes things happen and it increases the all the commentary and focus on him.
So we're close on to a year of Trump being elected, right? So, I mean, there is this kind of outrage fatigue. I think it's dangerous to kind of normalize this. On the other hand, the signal-to-noise ratio in our politics is out of control. And I think at The Nation, we talk a lot about how do you pay attention to what's happening under the radar. Under the radar might be all this deregulation, which is going to really shift. The deregulation, the rule changes, that's where we should pay attention. I've always said we pay too much attention to Donald Trump's tweets because someone says they win the morning and the news cycle that day or that week is defined by it. When we should, as journalists, be investigating what needs to be or taking off in a serious way. When Corker says what he says and we're looking at North Korea and Twitter diplomacy, so to speak, you do raise serious questions about how the nuclear arsenal of our country is controlled and why one man has the power with his button finger to launch a nuclear strike. But signal to noise, outrage fatigue, and paying attention to some of the real actions which are going to shape this country.
Bob, to what extent is managing this John Kelly's job? There's been some reporting, for example, that a lot of what Kelly has been doing has sort of been managing the president's inputs, controlling the flow of documents so that people can't put mischievous news stories in front of him or try to divert his agenda. Is sort of managing, keeping Trump focused sort of the key thing that Kelly does all day?
Yes and no. There's only so much he can do. My conversations with people around the president, it always ends around 6-7 o'clock when the president goes up to the residence that General Kelly is controlling the door to the Oval Office. He has a tight grip over the paper flow going into the president's desk. At the same time, when he gets up to that residence, whether it's early in the morning while watching Fox and Friends or late at night, he's calling Tom Barrack and Chris Ruddy and Carl Icahn and friends from New York who are giving him counsel. Sometimes he's calling political friends who give him aggressive advice about how to handle the Republican establishment or those kind of things. And that's what General Kelly just can't control, and he knows it. But he seems determined to stay there out of a sense of duty.
We're going to take a break. Up ahead, we're going to talk about Trump unwinding President Obama's Clean Power Plan. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. And our special guest is Robert Costa of The Washington Post and PBS's Washington Week. On Friday, the Trump administration announced that it will decertify the Iran deal. The White House is not saying Iran is out of compliance with the deal. The decertification says the deal is not in the American national interest, despite Iran's technical compliance. The move won't end the deal yet. It's up to Congress to decide whether to reimpose sanctions on Iran. And even Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, one of the deal's leading critics, says he wants to take time to press along with allies for revisions to the deal before doing that. But Cotton and the White House are also pushing legislation that would add so-called triggers to take the U.S. out of the deal. It would cause us to automatically reimpose sanctions if Iran takes certain steps, including steps related to their missile program that they have not already agreed not to take. So, Rich, I guess my first question is, how much does this move actually do? Is this substantive? Is this likely to lead us out of the Iran deal? Or is it mostly a way for the president to express his displeasure about having to stick with a deal that Obama made that he hates?
It's a little unclear. Clearly, the policy itself is a product of some of the incoherence in the White House we were talking about just a moment ago, where the president just hates this deal. He's wanted to decertify all along. There's been this enormous internal contention in the White House just keeping him from decertifying. And finally, everyone around him realized, we're not going to stop him from decertifying, so let's come up with a second best option to save the deal. At first blush, this seems potentially a clever policy, if you could really pull it off, where you could, in effect, revise the deal through Congress taking this action, which I believe the Europeans would probably go along with, and the Iranians, although they would obviously complain and yell and scream, might be willing to go along with as well, because the Iranians really want to stay in the deal as far as I can tell. But passing these provisions would take 60 votes in the Senate. They're very unlikely to get 60 votes in the Senate. So then the question will become, what do you do after that?
Katrina, we've heard comments at least from one of the other powers that participates in this deal, which is France. Emmanuel Macron has said that he's open to steps to strengthen the deal. Is there something to these complaints that the deal doesn't address the missile program, it just addresses the nuclear program, and that maybe we could make the deal better?
This is a very strong deal that took years of negotiation, and the negotiators who worked on it consider it a kind of gold star of what you can do on atomic diplomacy. I think it's been working. I don't know. Germany and the other powers who were part of the deal have expressed real reservations about reopening it. And I think punting to Congress is going to lead to mischief. I do think you'll have strong democratic unity because this, as I said, was the diplomatic triumph of the Obama years, and anything Obama is going to be defended. Sadly, I think that this deal could have been much more important in reconfiguring the regional, in opening up in the region. And there's, I think Saudi Arabia and Israel have played a role in pushing back against Iran, and there should be more regional diplomacy. But you do see the politics of it when everyone from Secretary Mattis and Tillerson to the U.S. and Israeli intelligence services, and yesterday I think Ehud Barak of the Labor Party, agree that Iran is adhering to the deal.
Bob, do you have a sense of how the White House ended up at this formula? We've seen this reporting that one of the key drivers of the tension between the president and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has been that Tillerson has been one of the people telling the president that he really, really needs to recertify the deal every 3 months, even though he doesn't want to.
That's spot on. Based on what I've heard from people close to Tillerson, is that he really does have more of a mainstream Republican, even not even really Republican. It's a mainstream, hawkish, but more interventionist, more internationalist in its worldview. I think the internationalist point's the most important, and that he believes that these institutions and these agreements should be respected and should be continued, maybe tweaked. But the president has this burn it all up mentality. And Tillerson, I think, has hurt his capital with the president in conversations in recent weeks because he just keeps underscoring in his quiet Texas way that this is the best thing to do, Mr. President. And the president fumes that this is not what's the best thing to do. I want to show people that I can cut a better deal. Don't you get that, Rex? That's the context of the conversations I've been hearing about.
There is a danger heading into the election season that Republicans will be pushed to take hawkish stances, run hawkish ads. It's hard to know throwing it into this Congress, even with a 60-vote limit. You could begin to see real mischief and damage done to a deal. And, you know, this is not just the European powers, but it was an international community supporting it. And I think the world is less safe and America is less safe if it does get unraveled, but that doesn't seem to be on the mindset of the White House.
So I want to turn and talk about Puerto Rico. The president has continued to have a fraught relationship with the island as it recovers from devastating hurricanes. As of Thursday, only 17% of electricity customers in Puerto Rico had power, and only 23% of cellular sites were working. And so the president has thought that this week is a good time to tweet that FEMA and the U.S. military can't stay in Puerto Rico forever, and that Puerto Rico has severe financial problems of its own making, and that Puerto Ricans know how bad things were before the hurricane. Rich, how do we understand the president going on about this?
Well, I think all these things are true. It doesn't mean that anyone should necessarily say them at this moment, certainly not the president of the United States. It just seems to a continuation of his extreme defensiveness over the criticisms from the mayor of San Juan and the media over the response to this hurricane. And it just doesn't seem complicated. In this instance, President of the United States, you should say, we're just doing everything we can to get after this problem. It's difficult. It's a grid that already had lots of problems. It's an island, you know, in the middle of the ocean, so it's not as easy as Texas or Florida, but we're going to get after it. And he's just unable to do that because of his thin skin and defensiveness.
It's like complete lack of empathy, self-centeredness. And there's a blame the victim politics, which is really ugly and un-American. I mean, presidents don't get to pick and choose who to help, Americans, which Americans to help at times of disaster. I think politically, let's not forget a lot of Puerto Ricans heading into Florida, a state where margins are often very narrow. But it's been really ugly to witness. And it's a measure of this president.
So aside from the president's comments, there's a disaster relief bill working its way through Congress that's not just for Puerto Rico. It's also for the Virgin Islands and Texas and Florida. And in addition to disaster relief grants, it's going to give a $5 billion bridge loan to Puerto Rico to pay for normal non-storm related operations of government. And so this makes a little more sense than it sounds like, because basically Puerto Rico's tax collections, as you might imagine, have not been coming in a normal way during the hurricane. And normally what a state does when it's in that situation is it borrows money on the short-term markets, but Puerto Rico doesn't have access to those markets because it's insolvent. So this is the short-term step. But in the longer term, it seems like you're going to need some sort of permanent relief, some combination of haircuts of the existing bondholders, a bailout rather than a loan from the federal government. Bob, do you have a sense that the White House has thought about this, that they have a longer range strategy on Puerto Rico, that there are conversations with the Congress about how the deal that they already had for Puerto Rico's troubled finances will be revisited because the hurricane will have done so much damage to the economy there?
There are intense discussions going on, and part of it has trickled out with the president's own tweet saying Puerto Rico can't count on money from the federal government. And a lot of people, of course, inside of the White House and the Republican Party on Capitol Hill are anxious about this because the president has committed to Houston and other areas of the country affected by hurricanes, full federal support. And FEMA has continued to work in Puerto Rico. These are Americans. And it's a challenge, though, for this Republican Congress because they know they're going to have to appropriate money for Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is insolvent. At the same time, they have so much on their plate, in particular with tax reform, that and they're going to try to pass this budget, which already has billions added to it because of the hurricanes. Billions more will be needed for the disaster relief. And this makes a lot of the budget cutters on Capitol Hill uneasy, and it makes the president uneasy.
I think there's a politics here. I mean, the Republicans look at Puerto Rico and don't see a politics for them that plays for them. It's mind-boggling when you think that Trump's request was for loans, not grants, when you bear in mind the territory is effectively bankrupt. Bankruptcy, he knows what that means. So I think there are a set of measures which won't happen in our immediate lifetime. But, you know, banks get bailed out. Hey, Puerto Rico, you need a Marshall Plan. You need to, the tax structure for businesses. There was a crucial tax break which was ended. And I think there are a set of measures which could restore Puerto Rico, but it's not in this Republican Party or White House's mind.
Well, we're going to leave that there. Robert Costa of The Washington Post and of PBS's Washington Week, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, I'm Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Trump's first year in office has been, well, it needs to be discussed. Let's put it that way. So we're going to do just that. On Thursday, November 9th, join me and a panel of LRC political visionaries for Left, Right, and Center Live. Oh, what a year. We'll look back at a year of big stories, fake news, and a whole lot of tweets. Plus, there will be a bar. For tickets, go to kcrw.com/events. We're going to shift the conversation from the White House down the street to the EPA. Scott Pruitt, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, announced this week that he would reverse the Clean Power Plan implemented under President Obama, which aims to reduce carbon emissions from power plants. To help us understand what that will mean, we've brought on New York Times Climate Desk reporter Brad Plumer. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So can you explain what the Clean Power Plan is and what the Trump administration is planning to do instead?
Yeah, this was a rule that was part of President Obama's broader plan to address climate change. And the Clean Power Plan was complicated, but what it basically said was it gave each state's targets for reducing emissions from their power plants and gave the states a lot of flexibility in how to meet those goals by 2030. So the aim was to reduce emissions from the power sector. It got put on hold by the Supreme Court in 2016, so it's never actually gone into effect. And Trump has promised to roll it back. So that's pretty much where we are now. Scott Pruitt has formally proposed, here's how I'm going to roll it back, and maybe I will replace it with something else down the road, but I'm not committing to that. And for now, power plants shouldn't have to worry about carbon regulations.
So there's a Supreme Court decision from a few years ago that obligates the EPA to regulate carbon. So even though the Clean Power Plan isn't a law and administrations are able to change these sorts of rules with a fair bit of flexibility, isn't there some sort of legal obligation for Trump's EPA to do something? And will there be litigation about whether the thing that they replace this with is satisfactory?
That's right. So right now what we're seeing is a lot of industry groups are saying, look, the EPA still has to regulate carbon. You know, some sort of regulation is likely inevitable. They would like Scott Pruitt to craft that regulation and say, do something modest that maybe only requires small efficiency improvements at coal plants or something else like that, but put some sort of plan in place so that we don't get sued, so that this isn't delayed forever. A lot of industry groups, a lot of state regulators are looking and saying, the Trump administration isn't going to be around forever. A new administration may come in. If we don't get something done now that we think is more modest and doable, we could be looking at Elizabeth Warren coming in 2021 and imposing something much more sweeping and ambitious.
Katrina, something Brad gets at there is that, you know, the federal policy here doesn't control everything. States do a lot of this regulation themselves. And so this has been sort of a hopeful thing for a lot of people who care about carbon emissions, saying that a lot of what was required under the Clean Power Plan will probably happen anyway.
I think it is. Brad knows far more. But many states are already moving toward cleaner sources of energy, even without mandates from the federal government. Market forces. Let's be honest. The proliferation of cheap natural gas, rise in renewable energy sources has made coal less economically competitive. And this idea it's going to rolling back Clean Power Plan, bring back coal industry jobs, not. I mean, the political point I always say is that we have to make this a war on coal's carbon emissions and not a war on coal communities. There has to be just transition toward jobs. But anyway, the shift has been so profound that I think the U.S. and many states may meet the original emissions goal of the Clean Power Plan, despite what's going on with the rollback of this and that.
Rich, what do you make of what they're doing here?
I think it's the correct thing to do. I think there's a reason that the courts stopped this Clean Power Plan. It takes an extremely obscure provision of the Clean Air Act, Section 111D, and piles strained interpretation upon strained interpretation to be able to impose this enormous regulatory scheme on the entire country. And surely part of the motive is that, yes, California is undertaking these sort of regulations itself, but there's a competitive disadvantage economically that comes with that. So part of the agenda here for the Obama administration was to even that out. So states that had more, I would argue, rational energy policies couldn't have them anymore. And the EPA, it can traditionally, you know, regulate at the point of pollution, but it can't dictate to the states what the mix of energy it's going to use to generate its electricity. And if we want to do that, and we want to have a federal law dictating to states how they should fight global warming, Congress needs to unambiguously pass that law. And there was an attempt to do it, you know, in the form of cap and trade in the Obama administration. It went down. So typically, this was an attempt to go around Congress and to effect right laws unilaterally.
Brad, it's kind of funny because one thing Rich is mentioning there is the desire from conservatives that, you know, that states should be able to choose economical choices for power generation. But then you have this other thing that the Trump administration is doing through the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is they're trying to draw some sort of rule that would effectively subsidize existing coal and nuclear plants that are getting outcompeted by natural gas. How would that work?
So this is something that Rick Perry of the Energy Department has asked FERC to consider. And he has basically said, look, right now we're seeing a lot of coal and nuclear plants retire, largely because of natural gas. He has argued that this poses a reliability concern and has proposed this pretty strange rule that says, basically, we would like FERC to compensate in the marketplace in deregulated electricity markets. We'd like them to compensate coal and nuclear plants if they can have a large supply of fuel on site, like 3 months worth of fuel. And so he's basically told FERC, consider this. Now, this flies against 20, 30 years of opening up electricity markets to more competition. Mm-hmm. And it's unclear that FERC will actually follow through on this. They are pretty independent. They tend to listen to what regional electricity regulators say. And this would definitely be a setback. But this proposal, if it came through, would probably allow a lot of coal and nuclear plants to stay open longer where they would otherwise retire.
I mean, to pick up on what Brad said, I mean, putting aside the dirty danger of it, but by choosing to subsidize coal and nuclear, first of all, you're going against trying to hold back history and progress. But the Trump administration is going to be doing, would be doing exactly what conservatives accuse the Obama administration of doing, choosing winners and losers in a free market energy economy.
Isn't this the weird thing where like the conservative argument for coal had long been basically that they want to replace coal with things that are more expensive than coal and it'll drag down the economy. Mm-hmm. But now it seems like coal has become an end in itself for some Republicans, even if it's more expensive than the other things that you could use to generate power.
Yeah, and part of that obviously is political because coal country is so key to Trump's victory. But I think energy subsidies, if you look at the history of them, they're always been a bad idea. We've never gotten anything from them. And as Katrina alluded to earlier, one of the greatest advances in fighting carbon emissions was an innovation and cheap energy in the form of natural gas. Mm-hmm. And maybe one day, you know, wind and solar and all the rest of them are reliable and more cheaper than fossil fuels. And in that case, I'd be all for them. I just don't think it makes any sense to try to force the spring on this issue.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave that there. I want to thank you for joining us, Brad Plumer of the New York Times Climate Desk.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Kelly Goff to talk about Harvey Weinstein. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Before we get to Harvey Weinstein, I want to talk briefly about a speech President Trump gave on Wednesday about his tax plan. President Trump spoke to the American Trucking Association, and his message was that business tax cuts aren't just good for big business, they're also good for the little guy, including truckers.
The biggest winners from this transformation will be everyday families from all backgrounds, from all walks of life, and our great companies, which will produce the jobs. They are going to produce jobs like you've never seen before. When companies leave our shores, it's the American workers who get hurt. And when companies stay in America and move to America, it's our wonderful workers who reap the rewards, including our great truckers, who will have more products to deliver and more contracts to fill. That's the way it happens. For the many American truckers who file taxes as sole proprietors, S corporations or partnerships, we will cap your top tax rate at a maximum of 25%, substantially lower than what you're paying now. The more than 30 million Americans who have small businesses will see, listen to this, a 40% cut in their marginal tax rate. 40%. I wouldn't want to be a politician against that.
So that 40% tax cut the president is talking about, you have to make over $400,000 a year to get it. So it doesn't go to 30 million Americans. It goes to about 670,000 Americans, including approximately zero self-employed truckers. So I guess my question is this. Is anybody buying this effort to sell tax cuts for the rich, this specific provision of the overall tax plan, this as being for the little guy?
unclear. There's no indication of that yet. It's very likely that the image of this tax cut will be that of most Republican tax cuts, that it's tilted towards the wealthy. And you really have to go out of your way to combat that image by really having something different substantively. This is where Steve Bannon, I don't think this could have passed Congress, but it would have made sense for Trump perhaps just to propose it. An increase on the top rate at some level would have sent that message. And policies that really would be tax cuts for middle-income, lower-income people, like a payroll tax cut, would also have that political effect and be much more plausible substantively.
To paraphrase Ronald Reagan, there may be no words in the English language more scary than a, quote, Republican president in Congress announced it is time for tax reform. Scary, should be scary for low-income working families in this country who've gotten shafted over decades. We need to tax work at the same rate as investment. That's nowhere in this plan. And Mnuchin and the other, you know, Goldman Sachs people aren't exactly the best salespeople for a tax plan. So when he stood there before those truckers, he also railed against the estate tax. And I think that, you know better, probably no one in that audience is going to get a benefit from rolling back the estate tax.
Maybe if they owned a large trucking company, but not the drivers.
So there's a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Should Democrats be out with a competing tax plan in the way that they're out there?
And there is, I mean, there's several. I mean, the Congressional Progressive Caucus has a people's budget, which is, you're right, you always need an alternative. You can't just rail against it. But there are smart ways of raising revenue that could be rebuilding this country. Taxing investment at the same rate as taxing work is just basic raw fairness, and closing loopholes for the very rich, and not about being anti-business, but about truly supporting small business in ways that would remind people that the Chamber of Commerce is essentially a lobby group for multinationals and big business.
But then if Democrats had their competing plan, there would be a question of what to do about the middle class, because you'd have two competing desires there for Democrats, right? They want to say Republicans aren't being nice to the middle class, we should have a middle class tax cut, but Democrats also want more government revenue to pay for things,
but
and they
I
have to pick.
Traditionally, Democratic tax plans have been far fairer to the middle class. You're right that there's a little bit of gamesmanship that goes on about the middle class, but no question that Democrats' plans have been more fair to low-income working people, middle-class people, than the Republicans.
Rich, are you hearing, I know that Marco Rubio and Mike Lee, some other Republicans, and especially in the Senate, have talked about the need for a more family-friendly approach that would focus on increasing child tax credits a lot instead of focusing a lot on bringing down tax rates. Is there any momentum around that for revising this plan?
I don't know whether there's any momentum yet, but if you have Mike Lee, Marco Rubio, and Rand Paul talking about that, that's the three votes you need to take down a tax plan. And I wouldn't expect, you know, in any real circumstance, Marco Rubio to be a no vote when push comes to shove, but certainly Mike Lee and Rand Paul are. So I think they'd have considerable leverage.
It's been quite a year in Trump's America. On Thursday, November 9th, mark the occasion by stepping out of your personal echo chamber. It's Left, Right, and Center Live. Oh, what a year. Join me and a panel of political experts from both sides of the spectrum for a look back at the tweets, firings, and even a few policies that defined the last 12 months. For tickets, go to kcrw.com/events. We can't really say we've covered the news of this week without discussing bombshell allegations that film producer Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed and even assaulted women in the business over years. Some aspects of Weinstein's behavior were an open secret in Hollywood. And there are plenty of comparisons to revelations about some of our political leaders, including the famous Access Hollywood tape of our now president, talking about what he could freely do to women. So from a left, right, and center approach, how do these allegations reflect our greater culture? Are there responsibilities that ripple down to the political world to reject this behavior? For that, we're going to bring one of our regular special guests who we haven't heard from in a while because she's been busy in a Hollywood writer's room. Kelly Goff is a columnist for The Daily Beast. Most recently, she's been working on an upcoming TV series, Black Lightning. She's also written for the series Being Mary Jane. Welcome, Kelly. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be back.
So do you find these revelations surprising or not?
No. I mean, I would say is I find the extent of them horrifying. I want to be very clear about that. I did not know that he was an alleged sexual abuser. But the allegations of sexual harassment, no, I do not find them surprising.
Do you think this is an especially big problem in Hollywood, or do we just see a lot of it in Hollywood? Because why is Hollywood particularly bad for this?
Because it's a business that a lot of people are desperate to get into. It's a business in which a lot of people are desperate to remain in it, you know, and also it's a fairly subjective business in that, you know, if you are an accountant, if you are a real estate salesperson, if you are someone who paints houses for a living, you know, they're pretty clear standard on whether or not you have talent and are succeeding at your job. There's a lot of gray area in businesses like the arts and entertainment. And because of that, that allows a lot of people to have outsized power in determining who gets what jobs and opportunities. And so I think it creates a culture of fear and desperation and abuse.
So one thing that has stuck out at me this week is we've sort of been talking about what did everybody really know? And I believe stars like George Clooney and Meryl Streep, who have been saying they had no idea about the worst particulars of his behavior.
I do too.
But so there was this sort of thing, though, that like what everybody really did know about Harvey Weinstein was that he was an immense jerk.
Yes.
And that he had this reputation for viciously publicly berating actors and actresses, assistants, wait staff, production partners.
And being physical with people, Josh. And being physical with people of both genders.
Yeah, he threw Nathan Lane against a wall at Hillary Clinton's birthday party because he didn't like a joke that he told about Rudy Giuliani. So I guess the thing that this has me wondering is there sort of a complicity that extends to basically everyone he did business with that, you know, even if you didn't know about his private behavior, his sexual behavior, if there had been a rule that said we won't make movies with someone who behaves this badly, who's such a jerk, that might have checked his behavior. It seems similar in a way to me with Donald Trump, where, you know, we didn't, before the Access Hollywood tape, we didn't know exactly about all that. But Donald Trump had behaved so badly in so many ways. And because people put up with it, that's how he got the idea that if you're a star, they let you do it.
I think you hit the nail on the head, which is that when people make a lot of money for other people, there are very rarely penalties for bad behavior. I was just having this conversation with a friend of mine who was talking about the decline of sportsmanship in professional sports and this idea that, you know, if a player on another team gets hurt, you go over and see how they're doing. You don't think, great, that's great for our team. And I think that's kind of representative of the crassness and the degradation of culture as a whole, in that if someone is really, really good at something, really talented or really beautiful, and it really benefits a lot of other people, there sort of are no penalties and parameters. And I think that that's what we ultimately saw at this situation, because to your point, while we did not know for a fact that he was accused of sexually assaulting women, we knew he was accused of assaulting people. I mean, and this was something he hadn't disputed when people would share these stories of, oh, he threw this person against a wall. Oh, he grabbed this person by the lapel. And there really hadn't been consequences because he made a lot of people a lot of money. And I think that you're absolutely nailing it, that that's the larger issue. It's really about bullying in American culture and poor treatment and poor behavior, and not just about treatment of women, although that's a huge part of the story.
Women help build the industry, but it's long been a male-dominated enterprise that systematically treats women as a class, as inferior to men. It's an industry with a history of sexually exploiting younger female performers. But there's another element of the complicity and the enabling, Josh. I mean, the role the media played. I mean, Harvey Weinstein, when he was very powerful, and part of the story is a man in whose power is diminished, and gutsy women have come forward to further diminish his power. But he had a lot of people on his payroll working as consultants or journalists. Someone who edited a Hollywood issue for The Nation a decade ago, Peter Biskind, was editor of Premier Magazine, I think it was 1991, and he wanted to do an investigation. The next thing he knew, Harvey Weinstein had a column at Premiere, and he was off that story. We've heard more of this. The other media piece is something David Remnick said the other day, which I think is important, that you need to be a powerful media enterprise. You need the funding to take on the rich. The financial struggles are such that journalistic institutions need the money to take on lawyers, fact checkers, experienced editors who won't be intimidated by whether it's the Harvey Weinstein or other protection racket. So I think there are layers of complicity. I think the women coming forward are gutsy. But the people, you know, there are layers of complicity, let me say, who knew what when. But it's a part of this story which is continuing to unravel.
Yeah, that's been sort of the conversation about why did this take so long to come out? And obviously part of it is there's a difference between sort of so-called everybody knowing something and being able to report it in such a way that you can defend it journalistically, defend it legally. And part of the question is, was it, you know, obviously there are all sorts of reasons why these accusers would not want to come forward, why it was difficult to get them on the record. But there's also, as you described, Harvey Weinstein is powerful and arguably is used to be more powerful than he is now. And so it made it a lot of people not want to take him on.
And also it's clarifying what everyone thought they knew. Because one of the things that you're hearing from certain staffers is that we knew he was a philanderer. We knew that he was overly flirtatious with certain staff members. We did not know that he was allegedly sexually assaulting women. And I think that that's part of the story. Because I certainly, as I wrote about for the Daily Beast, I believe that there is responsibility to be shared on the part of the Democratic Party for often going after conservatives for wars on women and looking the other way when Democratic men who were powerful behave badly. But you will never convince me that the Obamas knew that a sexual assaulter was someone their daughter was interning for. That is just not something I think any of us will believe.
Rich, what do you think about the politics of this?
Well, one, it's just shocking, obviously, and that here we are in the 21st century after all the focus on this issue, and you have someone who is perpetrating sort of the worst of stereotypical casting couch type abuses you'd associate from the beginnings of Hollywood or mid-20th century Hollywood. And he just had this incredible power because journalists, you know, he might option your news story, your editor might want to go to his parties, and there's just all these incentives for people to not talk about it publicly. And as Kelly points out, that is sort of baked into the cake to how Hollywood works and also TV to some extent. But it is annoying for someone on my side of the aisle when we've been preached at so often by Hollywood, every single one of these award shows, and they hold themselves up as, you know, the exemplar of American society and American progress. And Harvey Weinstein himself said this, that Hollywood is, you know, the best moral guide for our society. And they had this rot that everyone knew was there and didn't do anything about. In fact, you had jokes openly told at the Oscars about it at least twice.
Listen, I think all men who behave in this way should be held accountable. It's not about left or right. But let's not, I mean, the Week magazine this week has a cover with Roger Ailes, Donald Trump, and Harvey Weinstein. What happened at Fox, which presents itself as a moral voice for the heartland of this country, was not a pretty picture. But let me take it back just for one second, because the question of legal repercussions for Harvey Weinstein remains open. Someone I admire in this city, Cyrus Vance Jr., who is the Manhattan DA, has come under fire for exercising his discretion not to charge Harvey Weinstein with sexual assault. And there's a very interesting letter in the New York Times this morning, Friday morning, by someone who works with the Bronx Defenders, which is kind of a legal services outfit. And he says, in the South Bronx, people are routinely charged with crimes based on nothing more than the word of an accuser. There's rarely an audio tape. Prosecutors regularly proceed with charges despite the lack of corroborating evidence if they have a cooperative complainant. So Weinstein's case reveals a criminal justice system in which the exercise of prosecutorial discretion seems to depend on the size of one man's wallet, and that's not a healthy thing for our society.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Katrina, because, you know, what was also revealed, too, is that Cy Vance received a donation from one of Harvey Weinstein's attorneys, prominent attorneys, and there seems to be a bit of a money trail there that's disconcerting. And my first thought when I read that was that it was just a reminder of why we need more women in positions of power in Hollywood, yes, in the legal system. Leslie Crocker Snyder, the judge who was the first woman to launch a sex crimes unit in New York, actually ran against him and she lost. And I remember thinking at the time that, you know, it's just a reminder that we need women in positions of power who have their voices at the table because, for instance, if the Weinstein Company had not had an all-male board, I have a strong feeling these issues would have come to the fore sooner.
Yeah, that was quite striking, the all-male board.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
I'm old enough to remember 3 weeks ago when all the talk was of the glorious unity of NFL owners and players behind protests during the national anthem. Now, inevitably, this unity is breaking down and the NFL appears to be on the brink of a messy, humiliating retreat in the kneeling controversy, all because not enough people realized that kneeling during the anthem was the absolute worst ground for the NFL to fight on.
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
Do you trust Trump's short finger on the nuclear button? I don't. Whether any president should be entrusted with such unchecked, awesome authority is not a question of partisan calculation. For the sake of the nation, indeed humanity, it's imperative to reform U.S. nuclear weapons policy. Start with three concrete, common sense measures. U.S. should take its nukes off of hair trigger status, declare a policy of no first use of nuclear weapons, and prohibit this or any president from unilaterally launching a nuclear attack. Instead, pass the Markey-Lew bills, joined by Republican Walter Jones, prohibit the president from launching a nuclear first strike without a congressional declaration of war, there has to be a firewall erected so no single human being can impulsively launch nuclear weapons.
Kelly Goff, what's your rant?
In light of the news that broke this week regarding Harvey Weinstein, I want to give a shout out to Frances Marion, June Mathis, and Anita Luce, all of whom were pioneers for women in Hollywood. And now that I'm working as a screenwriter, I have a particular appreciation for what they must have gone through breaking down barriers. And despite how sad some of this news has been, I'm really hopeful for the future of women in Hollywood, because I'm hoping that this is the moment where women say, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore, and we can see more women leaders in Hollywood.
For my rant, I wrote a column this week called Make Politics About Government Again. This show was actually kind of nice this week because we talked a lot about public policy, but it feels to me like our politics has come to be dominated by two separate trends. One is fighting over small things like who we have statues of and what NFL players do during the national anthem. And the other has been fighting over things so large that the government can't really do very much about them. People will make statements like, I feel like I'm losing my country. I feel like the country is unfair. Things like that, it's so amorphous that you elect officials, there's only so much that they can do about them. And this sets people up for disappointment. They vote on these things, and then a government with someone promising to make America great again or to bring about hope and change, in fact, we discover that a given president probably can't change the country that much. And so I think part of making our politics more functional would be to revise our expectations about what politicians will do. Realize you don't elect a president to run the country. You elect a president to run the government. And so if we set goals related to the running of the government that politicians can actually achieve, and if politicians run on those sorts of goals, we might have less of the sort of disillusionment that we have all over the political spectrum in America. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Robert Costa, Brad Plumer, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dimillion produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.